to you folks for coming. We're glad that you're here, and we're glad that you're chatting and making friends with people and visiting, and that's great. My name's Peter, and I'm going to be your host or MC for tonight. And I'm going to introduce our speakers and then get us rolling. We have a musical guest in the middle here and keep us thinking on a different wavelength. But we're glad that you're here. And let me introduce first myself and then the speakers in order, and we'll get rolling. I did a Bachelor of Science at McMaster University and enjoyed that a whole bunch. Went into human services, working with developmentally disabled people, and have since done a Master's of Arts in Apologetics. And I feel like I'm a constant learner, always trying to acquire new understanding, and life is a journey, and I'm excited that you're here to join in the quest to understand the universe and everything else, as well as ourselves as a part of the big picture. So we're glad that you're here. Mike Perret is going to be our second speaker, and Mike has degrees coming out of his ears. He can't stop. He recently, to add to his Bachelor of Science, he added on a degree from McGill University in neuroscience, and then an MD, practices and trains doctors through the University of Toronto, and has since also added a master's degree in education to his credentials. Bob Giza is a great speaker. You're going to love his dynamic way of communicating with you. He's head of science at Chaminade High School and coordinates a table of science teachers. And you'll enjoy him. And then Tony Costa, like me, is a father of three. We're both married and enjoy our children. On top of that, Tony has done a Bachelor of Arts and an MA at U of T, and also is working on his PhD through the University of Pretoria. So we've got a good lineup of some interesting speakers. We've done this presentation before, but it's been over a four-week period. Tonight we decided we're just going to make things sizzle and put it all together in one night. And so we want to tell you about that. And then later, right after Mike's up, we've got Errol Lee. Now this guy is a dynamic and interesting guy. By the way, none of us are being paid. We have no honorarium. We're doing this because we feel that the message is important. And at our own expense, we've rented the facilities. And so, including Errol, who's just come here because he's a cool guy and wants to endorse what we're doing. But he works in York Region with youth to encourage them, and works with the police and does all sorts of wonderful and zany things. So you'll enjoy him. He's a true artist, a true lover of people. And they'll allow us a chance to have a relief from the cognitive overload that you're going to experience in the next couple of hours. My talk deals with the origin of the universe. And you probably know that atheists have maintained that the universe doesn't need a cause because it's eternal. And so we begin the quest looking at things from the largest scale tonight. Is the universe really eternal? And the story begins back in Egypt, 500 years AD, with a man named John Philoponus, who argued for a beginning. He said, by faith, we may believe that there is a beginning, but let me try to put this in some kind of rational context. And so he put together a three-point argument that the people in Islam grabbed a hold of and actually developed it very nicely into an argument called the Kalam, cosmological argument. And the idea of the Kalam, this man Al-Ghazi, who developed it, basically said that there's three levels to this, two premises and a conclusion. So the first premise is whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now we have to understand there, the wording of this is very carefully chosen. It's not everything must have a cause. It's whatever begins to exist must have a cause. So bear that in mind, because that will prevent some confusion later. Now, the universe had a beginning. We're going to look at some scientific and mathematical reasons to believe this second point. The conclusion, therefore, the universe has a cause. Okay? So this is our beginning point, and we're going to see how the evidence supports this thinking. Now, there's five factors that support the first premise. First of all, it's something intuitively experienced by us every day. If you can try to clearly grasp the concept of nothingness. Okay, now you might think of a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. The advantage that the magician has is he has a hat, and you start with the magician. In the case of the universe, though, it appears that there is neither a magician nor a hat to work with. Okay, so understanding the concept of nothingness as being void or complete oblivion really puts the challenge in its proper perspective. Secondly, the premise is constantly confirmed and has never been falsified. Through our daily experience, for example, right now you probably don't have the fear that there's going to be some wild boars or hogs that are going to appear in your living room and befoul your carpet. No one, I think, is worried about this right now, I hope. Okay? If you are worried about that, you need to speak to Mike, because he's a psychotherapist. Okay, then, legal evidence would be useless, because legal evidence depends on forensic science. And so, intuitively and forensically, we have a good reason to believe that whatever begins to exist has a cause. Otherwise, how could you have court cases where the attorneys are battling out, for example, a murder case or something involving theft, if they could appeal to something other than the law of causation? Okay? And then there's scientific reasons, quantum mechanics and so on, only enforces it more. And then finally, fifth, philosophical support from even the most ardent of skeptics. One that might come to your mind is David Hume. And he said in 1754, quote, "I never asserted so absurd a proposition that anything might arise without a cause." Okay, so even the skeptics do not deny this principle of causality. Now, there's mathematical support for this conclusion as well. First of all, something called antinomies, which if we had 2 hours I would describe, but I won't. Secondly, infinity, the concept of infinity, in other words, a universe that goes back in time for infinity, is not possible in a real world. It might be in an imaginary world, but you just can't have something like that conceptually. And then scientific support, that's what we're going to look at next. So, Einstein created this formula, and basically, the idea of the formula is, I can summarize what you get when you plug in the values. C is the speed of light, a very large number. It makes the denominator of the second term very huge. And what you end up with is a universe that is experiencing negative acceleration. In other words, it's decelerating. And you also discover that the universe is expanding. Now, when you think about going back 100 years to Einstein with his pencil on paper working this out, what do you think came to his mind as he thought, what else in life is expanding? What other natural phenomenon do you know of that is expanding and at the same time decelerating? And to his mind came an explosion. Right? At first, the particles are moving very quickly, and then over time, it slows down and things settle. So, the concept of the Big Bang was conceived. Then, around 1914, you had a guy named Vesto Slipper.
he noticed that what he thought were nebulae were receding, were actually going further and further away. When I was 7 years old, I went to the David Dunlop Observatory in Richmond Hill, and I was so excited. We lined up as kids in a big row to look through the telescope, and finally, when it was my turn to be at the front, I couldn't tell if what was in the lens was the object, the body that we were trying to look at, or if it was dust on the lens. And that's because astronomers are more fascinated with the tiny images that are far away than the near things like the moon and Saturn that would thrill a child. But this is what they were looking at. Now, as time went on, they discovered that these were not nebulae, they were actually galaxies composed of billions of stars. But they could actually observe them moving further away. Alexander Friedman was a Russian mathematician, and using mathematics, he predicted the expansion of the universe. And then finally in 1929, Hubble demonstrated the emission spectra. So this deals with how energy is distributed across a spectrum, and he noticed that there's a shift towards the color red, towards the longer wavelength. And you may know this as the Doppler effect. This is how police can use a radar gun to trap you as you speed along, comparing the reflection frequency versus the emission or transmission frequency. Okay, so the hot Big Bang model was developed through these various scientists. George Gamma detected and predicted a radiation temperature of 5 degrees Kelvin. So what they thought that is, if the universe had some kind of initial hot, expansive beginning, eventually, as time went on, things would settle down and cool down, and that energy should be distributed throughout the universe, settling not at zero, which is 0 degrees Kelvin, where everything's absolutely motionless, but settling around 5 degrees. And later, through Bell Labs, they were able to actually measure something that Gamma was not able to accurately measure. He could predict it, but no way to do that, to test his theory from Earth. And they found that it was around 3 degrees in actuality, 3 degrees Kelvin. So this background radiation is out there, and it helps us understand that there must have been a beginning. And then a certain satellite that we call COBE, it stands for Cosmic Background Explorer, was shot up into space in 1990. And it was now able to actually measure things more exactly. And here's what the COBE research found. The universe is a great radiator of heat, just like those black wooden stoves that you might have at your cottage or maybe in your home to burn firewood. They send out this beautiful warm radiations of heat, and the universe has done that. And they were getting more closer and more digits. It's 2.753 degrees Kelvin. As time gets on, more precise instruments can measure it to more degrees of certainty as time went on. So here's what it looks like. This slide shows the ripples in the background radiation. There's variation. That variation is about one part in 100,000. So the hotter areas are the red areas, and the cooler areas are the blue ones. And since then, over the past two decades, there's been more and more confirmations of this finding. Now, this becomes a very controversial piece of evidence in the face of atheistic scientists and philosophers. It's disturbing, and the scientists are not afraid to express their feelings in publications. So, for example, Michael Turner from the University of Chicago says, "This is unbelievably important. This is the holy grail of cosmology." Or Stephen Hawking says, "It is the discovery of the century, if not all time." George Smoot says, what we have found is evidence for the birth of the universe. It's like looking at God. So they're like astounded by what was found in 1992. Now, many people who have studied science, if you're over 40, this finding is something that may have escaped your radar. You may not have tuned into this finding, and so your science is out of date. And tonight, hopefully, the other speakers will help elucidate newer findings that will point us to further evidence that there is perhaps a designer behind the universe and not chance alone. Okay, so the scientists who are disgruntled propose alternative models. These are the five alternatives to a universe that has a beginning. Okay, the first one is an infinite universe, a universe that goes literally on forever and ever. Secondly, a steady state where things don't really change over time. And I would think that intuitively, when you look out into the stars at night, whether you're sitting on a beach or on your lawn gazing up, it just seems to be the same every day. You know, there might be a falling star once in a while, but otherwise the moon appears and goes through its cycle, and it just seems to be the same. So you could understand why people would argue for these concepts. The oscillating universe is the idea that things expand to a point and eventually contract back on themselves because of the mass that exerts its gravitational force, and then perhaps the whole thing repeats itself. The Hawking model is looking for a way to avoid the beginning by proposing that at the various early moments of the universe in time, measured by 1 times 10 to the minus 43, perhaps the laws of physics were different. And so we don't have to have a beginning. Maybe the universe popped out through some quantum quirky event. And that would explain it. And then lastly, the mirage universe is the idea that everything is just an illusion. And some of our songs, popular music, puts forth these ideas. So I'm going to move quickly. I only have 10 minutes left to move you through the remaining concepts here. The problem with the infinite universe is that the volume of the universe increases eightfold with the doubling of the distance, while the decrease of light is only fourfold with the doubling of distance. So you can see what happens. The result is that the amount of light falling on the Earth would double every time the size of the universe is doubled. Therefore, if the universe were infinite, we would not expect the sky to be dark at night. But it is. Since the night sky is black, we know that the universe could not be infinite. Follow me? Okay, now the steady state problem. We're going to have Q&A. We have 5 minutes between speakers. And then at the end, we invite you to come up. We have some drinks that will appear on the table behind the screen as the screen goes up. And you can interact with all the speakers and have your questions answered then. Now, the problem with the steady state theory is, and there's many problems with each of these, but I'm just highlighting one in each case so that we can be brief. We observe that stars are not measured to be older than 16 billion years old. This is giving the most liberal estimates of time. And some of us would even argue for much smaller spans of time. But a universe that's eternal would have much older stars. Stars can have lifetimes of up to 30 billion years. But there isn't any that are 25 or 30 billion years old. And the question is, why not? Now, because of this reason alone, there are virtually no cosmologists today who believe in the steady state model. Okay, now, oscillating model. Sometimes scientists thought that the universe may actually have some elasticity to it. Elasticity that would allow, as I said, the universe to rebound. Like a ball there. Hey, good catch. Okay? So the idea is a great idea. Maybe it just keeps expanding and contracting and going on forever and ever. Plus, if you come from a Hindu background, the Hindu scriptures seem to suggest that there is a universe reborn every 4.32 billion years. The Avatara Upanishad and the Bhagavad Gita speak of this. And so people say, well, if some holy scriptures say it and if scientists propose it, maybe this is a viable alternative to there being a beginning. And now, the problem with this is that there's two problems. There's not enough matter to cause the critical mass that's needed to attract this expanding universe to come back again. And then secondly, when we do the math, look at the physics. Instead of the universe being something like that ball that has so much elasticity, it's something more like this, and the result is like that. Okay? It's a big flump instead of a bounce. So, what do we need? We need a solution that would produce the change here that's necessary. The rebound can be examined more closely. If you consider the efficiency of a gasoline engine, about 25%, did you know that when you drive your car, because you're pushing it through air, heat loss through the friction through the air, the mechanical loss through the engine itself, and braking and all of that inefficiency, 75% of your gas is converted into heat and not into motion. But with a diesel engine, up to 40%. And the steam engine was only 12% efficient, but the universe is so small that it could never rebound. There isn't enough efficiency for even one cycle, let alone for it to be eternal. The problem with the Hawking model and his friend Hartle, they worked together on this, they thought that, as I explained earlier, there might be at the 10 to the minus 43, this is like just an instant, not even a breath after the creation event, there would be a new set of circumstances that would not require normal physics. And so maybe the universe popped out by some quirky quantum event. Maybe, but we have no evidence to support that. There's no way to measure or test this theory. And it also depends on imaginary time. And imaginary time depends on imaginary numbers. So, because neither imaginary time nor imaginary numbers actually exist in the real world, what we're describing is something that's entirely artificial. Now, this one I like the most. I enjoy this. The mirage universe. This is where people, it's a bit like suicide, you know, hoping that maybe if I kill myself, then everything will just be peaceful and nice again. Okay? The mirage idea is that, well, maybe life really is just a figment of my imagination, or maybe it's somebody else's imagination, but none of this is really happening. First of all, this whole way of thinking is self-stultifying, which means that it cuts its own throat. To suggest that all is an illusion is to suggest that not all is an illusion, and that's a contradiction. Now, the person who makes such an assertion seems to be able to distinguish between what is and what isn't an illusion, right? For them to conclude that the universe itself is an illusion, they have an ability or some quality that enables them to make this distinction, right? So, when a person says the universe is an illusion, there's really two options. Either they are separate from the universe itself, and therefore they can objectively make this bold statement, or they are part of the universe, right? Those are the only two choices. So, if they are separate from the universe, then not all is an illusion, because they would not be an illusion, but the universe would be, and they're separate from it. So So therefore, all is not all. That's a contradiction, right? It's really like an oxymoron. An oxymoron is a self-refuting statement. It says something like military intelligence or country music. Okay. So the other problem with this whole way of thinking is that there's no way to test this model. Okay, how can you test it or make any predictions or do experiments? And then here's the thing that really gets me is, why would anyone try to persuade you that you're not real and they too are not real? What would motivate someone who is an illusion to convince another illusion that all is unreal? It's amazing. Okay, so here's the implication. There seems to be a beginning to the universe where time, space, matter, and energy, even time itself, is a created dimension, came to exist at a point. And this is in harmony, really, harmony and faith together here, because there's four statements in the New Testament that actually says time came to be. And so when this kind of implication strikes someone who is trying to run away from the conclusion, they might say something like this. Okay, this is Stephen Hawking, and he says it smacks of divine intervention. Well, it seems that the science has theological implications. Now, to get a universe that's going to be just perfectly finely tuned requires perfect tuning. Right now, Scott's in the sound room, and you can imagine if he had adjusted the volume or the tone of something, he could play with it a bit, okay? Like, for example, the ground state of helium or carbon or oxygen. There's an allowance for about 4% fluctuation there. But not everything is so has as much tolerance as 4%. And I'll illustrate this. You may have some of this kind of household thing in your cabinet somewhere. And you know that there's different ways to adjust this. You could set it to a nice spray like this, okay. Or you could put it to a stream, and it really has some impact, right? So, by the way, this kind of smells good. Huh? In fact, some people have done some amazing things with these cleaners, and I was just. Whoa. It's actually not bad, is it? Okay, so what you've just done is you made an assumption, right? You made an assumption that I'm not drinking powder. And this is common in our everyday experience. The universe has to be finely tuned. It has to be tuned within parameters that are mind-boggling. Like, look at 1 times 10 to the 120. We're going to talk about presuppositions. The galaxy itself has to be supernova eruptions, 0.01. You have to multiply all these parameters with each other. And in the end, you end up with 323 parameters. And if you come to hear Dr. E. Ross on September 29th, you're going to discover that this list keeps growing. He's tracking these things. And we're bringing him into U of T. We'll tell you about that later. But you have to have 323 parameters all finely tuned. Now, imagine Scott trying to adjust the volume plus or minus 1 billion, or else the whole sound system doesn't work. Okay, that's the kind of situation we're dealing with in the universe. It ends up with a number that looks like this. Okay, that's how you have to fine-tune it. Imagine the job of a sound man who has to work with that kind of precision, or else you get no sound at all. A lot of these parameters are actually so fine that you get no matter in the universe if they're not correctly calibrated. And so, to get the probability, try telling your friend one day, a million, and then say trillion 23 times. And you get the enormous improbability. And in light of something called Borel's law, anything that has a chance of only 1 times 10 to the 50 has no chance of occurring. So how are you going to deal with 1 times 10, you know, something like that, right? If you want to set the National Security Research Council's standard, it's 10 to the 94. This is where you could put all of the world's computers together to try to break a code. And if the chance is 10 to the 94, there's no way for the code to be broken. William Dembski, who has 2 PhDs, said the probability bound of 10 to the 50 is impervious to all available probabilistic resources in the universe. In other words, you can't expect the universe to come into existence by itself and support life on its own because of these statistical absurdities. Okay, well, what are we talking about? Assumptions. We all make assumptions, presuppositions, and sometimes we're not aware of them. We do them blindly because they're based on things that have been taught to us as children or things that are really blind spots. We've just presumed and haven't realized we've presumed them until someone drinks Windex and helps you realize what you've just presumed. So, I've got 2 minutes for questions. I want to bring up the next speaker, Mike. And while we're setting up his slide, Mike, if you'd come this way, I'll take a question or two. We have a young man who we let set up his recorder, and maybe he'll share MP3 files. He's nodding yes. So if you speak to, what is your name?
Ryan.
Ryan, thanks, Ryan. We might be able to do that. Mike, you're getting yours ready. One more question? Thank you.
I'm not clear on why you said this COBE evidence in 1992 was so significant that they, some people described it as looking into the face of God.
Okay.
Can you explain again, what is it about this phenomenon?
Right. COBE is one piece of confirming evidence that... yes, one piece of evidence that corroborates the other findings and predictions. And because it was projected that the exact temperature was so closely matched between what was predicted and what they found, we find that to be confirming data that supports the concept that there was this singular point beginning. It's one thing to come up with a theory, you know, that you can say, oh, there's multiple universes. It's another thing to test that theory. And so a theory was put forth, and measurements were made. And every time the measurements are made, we have better and better technology that confirms that prediction to greater and greater precision. And so that's why they're saying, okay, we've got redshift evidence, we've got mathematical evidence, and now we're measuring things that says there's radiant energy that points back to a beginning, a hot beginning to the universe. Are you ready, Mike? I think you want this? Let's go. Put that somewhere.
So you made it. Thanks for starting here. Welcome. My name is Michael Perry. I'm a little overwhelmed. We thought there might be 20 or 30 people here, and it's like, wow, this is amazing. And I'm a psychotherapist, so usually I have an audience of one. So if I look nervous, that's part of the reason. I'll be talking again on science and faith and harmony. I used to be an atheist, or almost, about 5 years ago. And then I got skeptical of skepticism. Okay, now I'm trying to move the slide forward. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Thank you. Okay. It's moving here. It's moving in.
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't technology wonderful? Okay, so I'll be talking about my next slide. Origin of life. The chemical origin of life from non-life. That's what I'll be talking about. And I'll try to do it as quickly as possible within my time frame that Peter's watching. These are my credentials. Are my credentials up there? Good, okay. I'm an MD. I have a degree in medicine. I also have a degree in experimental neuroscience. I have a degree in psychobiology and health sciences as well. Today I'll be talking about science, not God or religion. I don't really care whether you believe what I say or not. I want to tell you a very interesting story. And I want to be skeptical. And I want you to be skeptical, but I don't want you to only be skeptical of me. I want you to be skeptical of some other viewpoints and wild speculations that other people tell you. Like it's obvious there's no God. I mean, that's one speculation I think is incorrect. And I don't believe these answers are obvious at all. So these are not things that are obvious one way or the other. Am I adequately trained to give this talk? Well, my academic credentials are going to be a little bit more. As a doctor, I've been very involved with being educated on life, especially keeping it alive, hopefully. And also a lot of science and theory on biochemistry, pharmacology, and physiology. Also my experimental neuroscience degree, chemical neuroanatomy of the brain, so 3 years of biochemistry, anatomical research into the microscopic cellular structure of the brain. Basically, after 3 years of intense work and 300 pages of thesis, I said, well, our data might suggest this, more work is needed. I have a degree in psychobiology, but a lot of it was biochemical, and my health science degree was also biochemical to some extent. So obviously, chemistry is a part of my training. Okay, so let's just dive right into a detailed description of the origin of life from simple chemicals, okay? Okay. What? Okay. Okay, don't worry, that's not it. Okay, let's go one step at a time. Okay, basically, I don't have time to talk about so much of what I talked last time I gave this talk, which was an hour and a half. So I'll try to get it down, obviously. So I don't have time to talk about basic biochemistry as background, the history of the theories of origin of life, and also a huge number of speculative theories on the chemistry of the first life, which is good because I don't understand half of them. But what I will talk about instead is the difference between the mechanistic theory of chemical evolution. Now, it sounds complicated, but it isn't. You'll see what I mean. And what I call the plus design model. And you'll see what I mean by that. I'll also mention quite quickly Darwin's amazing speculation and Miller's amazing experiment. And I'll conclude that Miller and others have identified some chemical building blocks of life, pretty impressively, and that finding is very good. But they are not even close to showing theoretically origin of life in their theories, or to creating life, of course. Okay, now I'm just wondering if this is working yet. Okay. What I see here is not what is up there, unfortunately. Okay, so about 4.6 billion years ago, the Earth formed. About 3.8 billion years ago, life arose here on Earth from inanimate matter, inanimate meaning not alive. Chemicals formed in the primordial soup, what they call the primordial soup, which is basically a thin broth of different chemicals on the Earth. And then chemicals bonded together, as chemicals tend to do, to form molecules. This is a theory, of course. And then molecules bonded together to make a living cell. Okay. Now this is a schematic of what I just said. Now I'll go through it again. Okay, so here we go. Time and chance and matter and energy and the laws of nature will equal to life. Okay, so this is the mechanistic theory of chemical evolution. So basically, you have these ingredients and you put them together and you get life. Okay? You've noticed there's no designer there, there's no design, there's no God. Okay, so that's the mechanistic theory of chemical evolution. It's an atheistic concept, no God involved. Okay, the plus design theory is actually quite similar, as you can see here. So we have time, and we have chance, and we have matter, and we have energy. I hope these things are coming out, yeah. And the laws of nature, but we have one extra ingredient here. We have plus design. That's why it's called the plus design theory of origin of life. And then we have life, and then we have design, which is also somewhat equivalent to information and intelligence. Okay, so I'll be talking about part of the story, and Bob Geezer will follow up. I'll be talking about from chemicals to the cell, and he'll be talking a little bit about Darwinism, which is fish to people. So this first part is called abiogenesis, which is the formation of life from non-life. Up to a cell. And then the second part of the story here is the more famous Darwinian evolution. We always hear about evolution, but we don't hear about abiogenesis because people can't pronounce the word. And they're not interested in chemistry. So it's also called from the goo to the zoo to you. So again, if somebody asks, what did you hear about tonight? You say, from the goo to the zoo to you. Okay, so basic biology 101 is that all living things share common biology and chemistry. Here's this little boy, but he shares a lot of characteristics with other living organisms. Amazing as it sounds, I mean, this is one of the shocking things about biology. They share similar types of tissues and cell types. This is not obvious when you look at a butterfly, that a boy and a butterfly are actually quite similar. Okay, if we look down closely, the boy is made up of tissues and organs, organ systems, and then organs, and then tissues, and then cells. And if you look closely at something like a plant, the body doesn't look much like a boy, but the organs start to look more like organs in the body. And then the tissues, it might take some expertise to know under the microscope which you're looking at, a plant cell or an animal cell. And then the cells are actually surprisingly similar. So here, it even goes beyond that to bacterial cells, which are actually quite similar to cells from animals and plants as well. Now, so all living things are fundamentally alike in many ways, at a cellular and a molecular chemical level. Things are remarkably similar. Now, they are also dissimilar. So that's the other point. Now, the atheists and people who deny God would tend to talk about the similarity of living organisms, not the dissimilarity. But certainly they are similar, and it is a shocking thing. Okay. And the cell is made up of a whole bunch of chemicals. Some major kinds are proteins and amino acids and nucleic acids, the famous DNA and RNA. Okay. Okay, let's go back to our theory of the chemical evolution of life. So here we are, 3.8 billion years ago, not a great place to visit or live. There's nothing around except volcanoes and hot water and stuff. There's nothing living, there's no place to have fun. What we do is we add to that some chemicals in this hot little broth here, and we add some of the things that we said, an energy source, maybe like electricity. We also add the laws of nature, okay, and we also add time, and we add chance, and then we get life. Okay, so that's the theory. Now, this was said by no other than Darwin in 1871. It wasn't in his famous book on the origin of species. It was actually in a letter to a friend, and he said, and I'll sort of pretend I'm him, regarding the first production of living organism, if and oh, what a big if, we could conceive in some one little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc. present, that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes. At the present day, such matter would be instantly devoured or absorbed, which would not have been the case before living creatures were formed. Okay, so this is an interesting thing. This is exactly what we just showed before in terms of this picture here. And that's what he described. Okay. So Robert Shapiro said Darwin's 1841 speculation is remarkably current today, which is either a tribute to his foresight or a lack of progress in the area in the understanding of the chemical origin of life. So this was just a speculation from way back when. And then one of my most favorite experiments in biology is the Miller experiment. So what he did is he wanted to test this. So again, I don't have time, so I'm going to rush through this. What he did in 1953, he was 23 years old at the University of Chicago. This was a few years later, of course. Okay, so what he did is he took an apparatus and he put some of these chemicals that were thought to exist in the earth at the time in a glass apparatus, and he shocked it and he heated it and he cooled it, and does anybody know what happened? Anybody know what happened? Yeah.
Amino acid?
Yeah. How long, do you know? About 5 days. So the tube, this thing down here, turned bright red, and he analyzed it, and he had amino acids, and was assured of a good PhD. So that's pretty impressive, amino acids, and I'll explain why that's important. So basically, the Miller's experiment and Miller-like experiments, because there's hundreds and hundreds of them after he did 100 more, and other people did thousands of other ones, they actually formed other basic building blocks of of nucleotides, which are the building blocks of what? Nucleotides are building blocks of what? DNA and RNA, yeah. And sugars that form carbohydrates, etc. So the basic building blocks of life. So Miller's experiment shows that the basic building blocks of life can be formed naturally. Okay. Okay. Now, what was my reaction to these experimental findings as a 12-year-old kid? Okay. I was very excited. I admit I was nerdy for science, and I still am. And for me, these things are not very exciting, but this is very exciting. Okay? So why was it exciting? For me and a lot of people, it wasn't just me. His experiment stunned the world because these amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. And further experiments by Miller and his colleagues and other people yielded all of these major building blocks of other important chemicals in the cell. And this is big time news. It splashed across the world. And the discovery appeared on the front pages of newspapers worldwide. Even the New York Times said, life in a test tube? Yeah. People hailed these experiments as the first step in the origin of life by a purely mechanistic, naturalistic pathway. In other words, putting God out of business. The question is, well, is it life in the test tube, or is it even close? You know, what is the status of these discoveries? Okay, well, we talked about building blocks. So Miller and others have produced some of the fundamental building blocks of life. So we have amino acids, we have nucleotides, and we have simple sugars. Okay, so here we have a amino acid, and they will form together to form proteins, which are a major component of the structure of your body, actually. Now the other one here is nucleotides, and they link up to form DNA and RNA, which is extremely important, as you know, for your genetic components and your genes, etc., etc. And the simple sugars will link up to form carbohydrates, which are another major component of your cell. So quickly, basic chemistry 101, amino acids link up in this way. These are the building blocks. They link up to covalent bond to form a polypeptide, which again forms, if it's longer, is a protein. So here's a protein. It's like a long string of letters, which is amino acids that form a protein, and then it curves around, and I'll show you that. but it's a long molecule that flips around and gets folded in, but it's made of amino acids. And then it gets folded in. So the actual structure is more like what's on your right there than on your left, because it gets folded in a very complicated way. So that's the structure of proteins, and they make up your cell. Okay, so there's the amino acids, and how do they get into this secondary structure? You know, from amino acids just linked up, how do they get into this complicated structure? Now, one thing is, maybe they auto-attract each other. You put them in a test tube, and the amino acids come together, and you got a protein. You know, maybe you have to heat it up or something. Does that happen? Anybody know? Does that happen? No, it doesn't happen. The problem is, amino acids do not auto-attract in that way. Part of the reason is that proteins are important, and their function is based on specificity of the sequence. So they're not just put together in a haphazard way. They're very specific in terms of the order and sequence of the amino acids. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up fairly soon. How much time do I have here? Okay. Amino acids are bricks and building blocks. Okay, so amino acids are bricks. So amino acids are to proteins as bricks are to what? Anybody? Sorry?
Houses.
Close. Actually, you're right. I say walls, but houses too. Good. So here we have a slide, which is amino acids are to bricks as proteins are to walls, as the cell is to a house. Okay, so there he is. And I should go back, okay. The limitation of his experiment is that he didn't obtain proteins. He just got the building blocks. So that's pretty good, but that's not getting the proteins. The question is, well, is it life in a test tube? No. So here is what he really got. He didn't get almost life, he got building blocks. Okay. There's no bricks. So our analogy is that the brick house is an analogy of the living cell, and you can see the complexity in this, even in this painting of a living cell. So here we have amino acid is equal to a brick. We have Miller's bricks, but how do you get from the bricks to all of those big buildings? Life is a large complex building, at least. Another analogy here is that here's a drop in the ocean. Miller's brick is a drop, but how do you get life as an ocean from a drop to an ocean? And another one here is the Miller's brick is a loony. How do you get from a loony to a billionaire? Life is a billionaire. It's not just a loony. So, here we have our analogy, amino acid cell, brick, house. How do we get from a brick to a house? We do it by design, information, plan, and presumably the analogy follows through. So quickly, even Miller confessed the problem of the origin of life has turned out to be much more complex than I or other people envisioned. And I'm going to skip the next two slides because I'm running out of time, obviously. Francis Crick, does anybody know what he did? That's right. He discovered DNA. So, and this is pretty amazing. To an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to satisfy it to get going. He's actually an atheist, and he believed that life came from another planet because he couldn't figure out how it could start here. And I'll wrap up. I'm going to skip that. I'm going to skip my those things, and I'm going to just hear origin of life. Okay, theory and evidence can point to a design model, okay, a theistic model, and also it can point to a mechanistic I just think that the evidence is mostly toward the design model. I'm not saying that there isn't evidence toward the theistic, the atheistic model. And again, finally, our final slide, which is time and chance and matter and energy and the laws of nature and design can give you life. And that is actually the design model. We have added the design. From design, we have information and intelligence. And I'll stop there. A designer. That's my last one. Thank you.
Time for a question or two while Earl comes down. Earl.
The only thing I don't like about your model plus design there is the chance element. Because common sense would tell us that no designer ever throws chance into the mix. You don't design a building by, taking some plants.
Jackson Pollock? Have you heard of Jackson Pollock?
Yeah, I wouldn't call that design.
He's a famous painter that splashed. Paint on the canvas in one of the most regarded American painters. So he actually used a lot of chance. I'm a painter too, so I use a lot of chance. But chance is actually a major part of a lot of things.
Yeah, but did you get your PhD through any chance process?
I was lucky to get in. So, any other questions?
Is the only way that the plus design model to really work with the assumption of a deity of some sort? Because from what you were saying, if design is synonymous with intelligence, then couldn't intelligence be reduced to some sort of chemical, be reduced to molecules, chemicals, and therefore that model be reduced to the mechanistic way of thinking?
Yes and no. Certainly the designer doesn't have to be God. It could be a super intelligent race that came down to Earth. That's what Francis Crick believes. He thinks that he believes in what's called directed panspermia, which is somebody out there sent life here to have life grow on this planet. The problem with that is then you have to go, how did life originate on their planet? You see, so then you still have a problem. You avoid it for a second. Then there's other theories, but I think that when you come to design, we think, and this is what Peter said too, which is that you have design and you think of a designer. So I can't say that there's no other explanation. It just seems that seems like the most likely explanation is that such a thing as a designer, and probably since it's a big universe, it'd be hard. Somebody had to create the whole universe, and you couldn't have a super intelligent being doing that, because who invented a super intelligent being? You need God if you're going to describe how the universe itself started. But I better stop because
thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike. I'm so glad that Earl's here.
Serve this world we're living in. If each one brings one, surely care for someone. Maybe then we all can become one. From this world we paint every nation of creation. We can know the people and we know the people on somebody. Join hands with me. We can call the people and we know the people want somebody. We can call the people and we know the people want somebody. Join hands with me. We can call the people and we know the people want somebody. We can pray the
are we up here? That's so cool. It's a great way to digest the heavy stuff we've been thinking about, right? Thank you, Earl, for lifting our spirits and giving us a chance to get to the next step, which is Bob. Come on up here. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, we're all set to go here. I've been teaching biology for 30 years at the present time. I'm in my last few years. It's amazing. After those 30 years, I'm thinking, well, why did I get fooled that much? And what got me going was I read a book in 1995, Darwin's Black Box. I would suggest, if anything perks your interest here, to read this book. He says at the end of the book, by the way, the author of the book, Michael Pagy, says, what we should do in science is walk around today, give everyone a high five, and say, let's take the next week off because we have just made the most interesting discovery in science. It's not a random universe. Now, what does he mean by that? So he has written a book, 200 pages. I'm going to summarize one tiny little aspect. If someone could explain to me this point that I'm bringing up, I will capitulate. I will jump over to the other side. I think there's a problem here. And I have asked people, Michael Bay, he said he has asked people, nobody has ever explained this simple little idea. So this whole talk is on one simple little idea. And if somebody can explain this idea, then we're in the wrong. And he says, because of this idea, that the Darwinian theory of evolution goes out the window. Well, if the thing goes out the window, my brother goes crazy at this point. He agrees with me. If you start to go through this and you say, well, this theory goes out the window, what are we left with? Well, the simple analogy is you walk into a forest and there's a watch there. Either somebody designed a watch or it just happened to bounce together. What we're going to show you right here is, as Michael Bay says, it doesn't look today. I studied biology in 1965 down at UNT. The professor drew a cell, a simple cell. Here's a nucleus and here's a bunch of jelly. We now know that's the most complex thing on the face of the earth. I'm teaching grade 11 biology right now. I said, of course it has to be complex because that first cell makes you. It's incredibly complex. And because of that, people are now looking back and saying, Darwin didn't have it right. The reason I go crazy about this is the entire edifice of biology is based on evolution, on Darwinian theory of evolution. The Darwinian theory of evolution. If the Darwin theory of evolution is out the window, what replaces it? What replaces it? And people will say, it looks like maybe things are designed. One of the funniest things. So I've been in on this talk about intelligent design. Intelligence of design has got a bad name in the last year. My kids come into class and they laugh like hell because they put my name into Google and get this crazy guy out of the classroom. He is a nutcase, he's a religious nut. And the abuse you take if you mention this word or these words intelligent design. So I'm going to try in 10 minutes to get one tiny little point across, which Michael Beatty tried to get across, which seems to put a major problem in the whole Darwinian theory of evolution. If somebody can explain how this works in this theory of evolution, fantastic. So it's one simple little idea I'm going to try to get across. So that's why I call this the crux of the controversy. So this talk will not be complex. It's one tiny little thing. So here we go here. No, we don't.
Okay, we got it going now. No. Let's try one. Okay.
Well, it wasn't designed by man anyway.
Well, this afternoon in class, I started talking about brown trout fishing. I'm a man of brown trout fishing. I just caught a big brown trout, so I'm ad-libbing like hell as I'm wading through. 20-inch brown trout. On a fly rod, I just made the little Fergus Hall of Fame by catching a 20-inch brown trout on a fly rod.
It's on the screen, man.
I'm ad-libbing as much as I can.
Technical support, rescue me.
It's up on there, but it's not working.
Okay.
This is kind of my allotted time.
Can you go without the slides?
Sorry?
Can you go without the slides? Someone want to rescue us?
Reboot?
Go Michael.
Okay, let's bring Errol down. Errol.
Errol.
The car was on. Errol, hold up. The car was off. Okay, we're back in business here. Okay.
Okay, back on track here. So here we go. One simple little idea. This whole talk will just have this one simple little idea here. For 30 years, I've taught the theory of evolution in the classroom. I believed it. I thought it was kind of wild stuff to make everything just for these random chance things happening. But I went for it until I read this book. And I have talked to a number of people reading this book saying, what is going on here? So I'm just going to go through what I taught for 30 years, the major points in the theory of in the Darwinian theory of evolution. There's a large population. These animals are struggling to survive. There's variations because of mutations, meiosis, mitosis. There's variations in the population. The crux of this whole thing is this natural selection. And what I mean by that, if we have this giraffe right here, to get this whole idea, Darwin's idea, he says natural selection goes along and works on this animal. How does it work on this animal? The environment says this animal gets more of the food. If that animal gets more of the food, it produces more gonads, more sex cells, and it passes it on. So the whole idea of the Darwinian theory of evolution is natural selection, and here is the crux, works on a finished product. So the finished product is this giraffe here. This thing is taller, gets more of the food, therefore is healthier, produces more gonads or sex cells, and passes it on. Simple idea. By the way, I still believe that today. And many biologists will say we believe that. That is called microevolution. A simple little change is manifested. The environment says this is the best one, and it passes on its gonads or sex cells, and we do it. But from 1965 to now, we know many things are much more complex than this. It's not one tiny little step. So here is the crux of the controversy right here. Along comes this Michael Behe. And he says, now wait a minute. And he's not an evolutionist. He's an invertebrate biologist. And he read a book. So I read his book and said, Eureka. He read a book and said, what was I thinking about? And his point is, if you start looking at things, they're irreducibly complex. Now, how does that fit into the Darwinian theory? Well, there's one idea. So, when we say the local government efficiency machine, I could say this is, so in this efficiency machine, I want to get the money out of the back pocket. That's the end result of the evolutionary process. I want to measure how much money I can get out of the pocket. Most biological systems are complex like this. They're not one little step. The giraffe makes one little step. The environment says yes, because you're taller, you get the food, and everything works. They're complex like this. There's one step leading into the next step leading into the next step. So this idea is, there's a creature without an eyeball, and we have to get an eyeball. So now, let's use the Darwin theory of evolution, and we have no eyeball in a creature, we're going to make an eyeball. You need a series of one step, follows the next step, follows the next step. But the Darwin theory of evolution works on a finished product. If you don't have an eyeball in a creature, and you have a mutation, and we're starting to build an eyeball, one-fifth of an eyeball is no good. Natural selection doesn't say, I'm going to choose this, because natural selection works on how many gonads and sex cells you produce. You've got one-fifth of an eyeball, you're not catching any food, you're not breathing, it's not working. So these complex systems do not work, and that's the whole crux of the argument. Michael Behe says, macroevolution does not work on this. Microevolution, small little changes, a rabbit going from black to white, no problem. If you have an eyeball, no problem. We can make it a little better by tiny little steps. But when we start to see the problems, the first cell on the face of the earth, the first eyeball, the clotting of blood, how do you do them? Because natural selection works on a finished product. To go from no eyeball to a finished eyeball is a million steps. And there's no natural selection in those million steps. That is the whole crux of the argument. If someone can explain how Darwin can take his theory and explain no eyeball to an eyeball using his theory, then many people said, we capitulate, we'll go that way. It doesn't seem to hold water in that. So, just going on with this idea, here, come on. What's the most amazing thing is Darwin said this himself. He says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, an eyeball, existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. This theory has broken down. We know about 100,000 DNA. How did you make it by a successive series of small steps where each step is not selected for? You select for the finished product. You select when the eyeball is made, because then that creature can touch the food and you pass it on. And Michael Behe goes and asks, why don't people get that point? It's a simple one little point that people either, I don't know, but they don't seem to get that point. I don't know if anybody in here is getting that point. So from this here, okay, here, if we take this is a typical step. You had no cell and you had a cell. A million steps. What directs the million steps when natural selection isn't working? Natural selection works on a finished product. We have no cell. There's no such a thing as a simple cell, by the way. We talk about this in the class all the time. A cell is complex. You have to either make your food or get your food. That is a cell. A million steps. What directed the series of reactions here to put it all together, one after another? So we got problems. And Michael Behe summarizes this problem by saying, it's not random. It is not a random process. We should give each other a high five, take the day off, and say, this is not a random process. Then you get into the seat. So there. See, I think there's two arguments right here. As I go around and I get abuse and all the rest of it, I'm putting down this thing set in stone, the Darwinian theory of evolution, you better not say anything against it or you're going to get abuse. Well, a lot of people are saying, say, would you explain this point? How do you make these complex work? So that is one point. That's where I would love to end this argument. I think, and many people think, there's a problem with this. I'm going to give you a quote in a second on this. The next step is, okay, so it's not the Darwinian theory of evolution. We did make everything on the face of the earth by randomly putting things together. Where do you go from there? And this is where a lot of people, well, can you bring in an intelligent designer? Well, I don't know how simple this can be. You find the watch and the force. Either it bonds together, which we now say doesn't seem possible. So we designed it. Is there other possibilities? Well, Crick has. Michael Farley said, maybe it came from another planet. Well, that doesn't help any. It had to be somehow made up there. I kind of simplify things. It's one of these two. And this one seems to have problems today. Okay, this was the wrong set of slides. So, can you get on the ID redone? Because there's a quote, the best evolutionist in the States today, she's considered the top evolutionist in the States, a lady called Lynn Margulis. And I would love to finish this by her quote. She is an evolutionist, but she's not a Darwinian evolutionist. And of course evolution is occurring. Of course it's occurring. But is it occurring by the way that Darwin said is what a lot of people are questioning today. Yes, here it is here. So here's Lynn Margulis, distinguished professor of evolution at the University of Massachusetts. She said this last year about the Darwinian theory of evolution. It is totally wrong. It is wrong like infectious medicine. Infectious medicine was wrong before Pasteur. It's wrong, like phrenology is wrong. Every major tenet of it is wrong. I find that unbelievable because all biology is based on the Darwin theory of evolution. If that's right, and she's one of the best evolutionists, and many people are starting to believe this, and Michael Behe wrote the book on this, well, where do we go from this? And that's where this intelligent design came from. Because there's problems with this, then you say, if it's not random, what the hell's causing all this? Maybe, bad words here, but maybe somebody with intelligence started to put it all together. That's the simple idea.
Thank you. We have time for a question or two for Bob.
Questions?
Aren't some eyes in nature more complex than others?
Sorry.
Aren't some eyes in nature more complex than others?
But the point is, and this is what a distinguished biologist said, you have the simplest eye spot. And it's that's the major discovery since 1965. See, 1965, there's a cell, a little bit of protoplasm. We now know these things are incredibly complex. A simple eye spot. So you have nothing, and you have to go to a simple thing that takes in light. Incredible complexity. And what directed the steps of that? See, I got fooled by that for a long time. Oh, we're going to make a simple. This is how many biologists got fooled. Oh, we're going to start here. We'll make a simple eyeball. No, there's no such a thing as a simple eyeball. There's no such a thing as a simple cell. And that's the major scientific discovery in the last 35 years. The incredible complexity. You take, we're going to make a simple cell in the body. Simple cell in the body is not simple. You take a cell of the body by cloning and you make another you. It's got all that information in it. It's got, billions of nucleotides of DNA in it. There's no such a thing as simple. So now, how do you just randomly make these supposedly simple things that we now know are not simple is the crux of the argument. I'm glad for that question. That's a great question.
Thank you, Bob. All right. One more.
How would you like to be a millionaire?
I don't get the crux. No pun intended. I don't get the crux at all.
I'm sure everyone in the room would like to be a millionaire, right?
Yeah.
Right? So this is my thing. If you have an idea and it's money making, wouldn't you go for it?
So you're saying this idea here?
No, I'm talking about Darwin.
I see. So you're saying
like Darwin had this idea of hanging out at home, okay?
He thinks,
maybe if I
see
this, I could be a millionaire.
But an interesting point is, Darwin came out of this 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And today, if you go into the establishment today, Lynn Margulis made that comment. By the way, she said in that article, she got blasted royally, like I'm getting blasted. You say anything against this basis of biology, for some reason, this is the cornerstone of biology. The Darwinian theory of evolution. You know what a friend of mine just said? The only way this theory ever goes out the window is all the old time Darwinians all die. And the new generation like this might start to say, maybe we got this wrong. Because the old timers, you say anything, they roll their eyes and walk away from you and tell you to get out of the classroom because you are a nutty religious person.
Besides the thing, I'm coming from a month, right? I don't think I'm coming from a month. My thing is like, if evolution does exist, why aren't monkeys today becoming humans? Why aren't they transforming? Right?
Let's end it there, Bob. That's great. Thank you. Tell me you guys have the mic. And what you have just received is feedback that will give us some help to shape a future presentation. If you have a pen, you can fill that out and leave it with someone. Leave it at the back on your way out. Or leave it with one of us, that would be great. And after Tony's finished, we're going to ask Errol to do maybe one or two more songs, since you love him so much, and so do I. and then I have a brief announcement about this event at U of T. We want to urge you to come, especially on Friday night, which is free. Okay, so Tony, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Speak to us.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. And I guess you saved the best for last. I guess it'll be judged. Well, I want to talk to you tonight, and we have this discussion tonight, talking a little bit about the origin and the nature of science. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the origin and nature of science, and that there really does exist a fine line between science and faith, and also with philosophy. Now, today in our modern world, when we speak of science and faith, it is usually assumed that we're talking about two opposing fields, two opposing categories, and that these views are usually deemed to be diametrically opposed to each other. They're contradictory. And so people believe that if you're scientific, well, then there is no place for faith. And if you are religious or if you have faith, well, really there's no place for science. Science is the realm of fact and the realm of knowledge, whereas faith is the subjective experience, the subjective feeling that people have. And so there's this dichotomy that is presented that somehow science and faith are really foes. They make bad bedfellows, and they really cannot get along. And I think that really is a myth, particularly when we look at the history of science and its origin, and only to find out that many scientists today live by faith. Many scientists today depend on faith. And so what I think we have in our modern world is we really have a theological fallacy here, a logical fallacy of a faulty dilemma, where we're told it's either science or faith, and the twain shall never meet. Now, the point that I want to discuss here tonight is the fact that science is also philosophical, that science is made up of faith. The Greek philosopher Plato was right. He said that we all must begin with a worldview. What determines our meaning in life is how we view the world. And how you view the world will determine how you treat each other. It will determine what you believe about the meaning of life and whether life has worth or if it doesn't have any worth whatsoever. But really, we come down to three basic questions that have been asked by humans throughout history. Scientists ask this question. But these questions are really more philosophical in nature. These three basic questions have been asked virtually by philosophers, scientists, theologians, and to the present day, we continue to ask these questions. And they boil down to the following three. Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? Or where am I going after I die? And so the first question is one of origin. The second one is really an existentialist question. Is there meaning to life? Is there purpose to life? And the last one is what we call a teleological question, the question of purpose, the question of destiny, the future. Now, these questions I submit to you tonight are, I believe, are both scientific, but also deeply philosophical in nature. And really, these two fields intersect here. You see, science and philosophy do try to attempt to answer these questions. Socrates once said, and I think Socrates is right on this fact, and he said that the unexamined life is not worth living. We intuitively question our existence. We want to know why things are the way they are, and this is really the root of science. The word science, of course, coming from the root word in Latin, which means knowledge, to gain knowledge about ourselves, about our universe around us. And so there is a correlation here. Now, philosophy, when I say philosophy, folks, there's a fine line between philosophy and theology. Theologians have always understood philosophy to be the handmaiden of theology. And so when I say the word philosophy, there's a really fine line between that and what we call faith today. I want to talk a little bit about the history of science and where our idea of science developed. It comes from, of course, the ancient Greeks. Western philosophy, Western science finds its roots in what we call the pre-Socratics. These were philosophers who preceded Socrates, like Thales, Parmenides, and Heraclitus. Some of these philosophers came forward and said, well, all of reality, all of matter is made up of earth. Earth constitutes everything. Others came along and said, no, it's air. Air is really the basis of all reality, of what exists. Others said it was water. Others said it was fire. And then others came along and just wrapped them all together and said, well, it's earth, air, water, fire. And then, of course, the greatest two philosophers that have molded Western civilization and Western thinking, Aristotle and Plato, Aristotle, of course, being the student of Plato, these two philosophers were the pioneer forerunners of these two schools of thought known as empiricism and rationalism. Rationalism is the view that you can discover your world purely by using the mind, that the mind could discover things. For instance, René Descartes, one of the greatest rationalist philosophers who made that famous statement. Remember what was his famous statement? Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. I don't necessarily agree with Descartes. I think Descartes put Descartes in front of the heart of the horse. And the reason why he thought was because he was alive, he was in existence. And of course, Descartes begins with the premise, well, let's assume the whole world is just a myth. It doesn't really exist. It's all an illusion. Peter was talking about the mirage theory. Let's assume everything is just an illusion. It really doesn't exist. And while Descartes could doubt everything, there's one thing he could not doubt. He could not doubt the fact that he doubted. Just like the skeptic. The skeptic can deny everything, but one thing that the skeptic cannot deny is that he does deny it. And so rationalism, the mind, and then there's empiricism. Empiricism is based on the five senses. This is what scientists use today. Sight, hearing, touch, taste, they use the five senses to determine reality. And rationalism is based on the abstract mind. And then there are people who will say all that exists is material, materialism. And so in that case, never mind. Then there are those who say, well, it's all an illusion, it's all in the mind. In that case, it doesn't matter. And then Immanuel Kant came along, and what he did was he said, look, guys, both schools are right, and so what he did was he merged empiricism and rationalism together. Now, who is this gentleman here that you see before you?
Galileo.
Yes. Yes, the man who would be delighted to hear that his country won the World Cup, even though Zidane headbutted one of the soccer players. But Galileo here, and whenever we think of Galileo, what do we think of? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? What's that? Okay, the Catholic Church. And what did they do to him? They tortured him. That naughty church put this scientist in house arrest. Now, of course, there's a lot of stuff that we're not told. For example, Galileo was put under house arrest by the Roman Catholic Church. That's true, but his pension was paid for till the day he died. And he later admitted that he was quite foul-mouthed when he referred to the Pope. And so he understood why there was a lot of antagonism. Now, the reason why I bring Galileo up is to introduce to you one of the greatest myths that we hear in our science classrooms today. And that is that Galileo was a scientist and that this horrible faith institution called the Roman Catholic Church, they came along and they put him in prison because he was adopting the Copernican worldview, which said that the sun stood in the middle and that the earth and the planets revolved around the sun. Remember, Copernicus came along and said, the earth is not the center of the universe. The sun, planets, and the earth go around it. And so Galileo adopted this, and the church, of course, everyone is taught, the church thought that the earth was the center of the universe and that the church was reacting to this new scientific find. But in reality, this was not a case of science versus faith. In reality, this was a case of science versus science. And the reason why I point this out is that the geocentric model of the universe, which is the idea that the earth is the center of the universe, was not proposed by the church. It was proposed, actually, by what's called the Ptolemaic model. The idea that the earth was the center of the universe and that the sun revolved around it came from the pre-Socratic philosophers. Plato also taught a geocentric universe. Aristotle taught a geocentric universe, but it was not until Claudius Ptolemaeus in 150 of the Common Era. Claudius Ptolemaeus was, if you will, the scientist of that century. And he put it in stone that the earth was the center of the universe, simply following what the Greek philosophers had taught before him. Now, this guy, Thomas Aquinas, is very important because Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, who is the official philosopher of the Roman Catholic Church and still is to this day, Thomas Aquinas was an Aristotelian scholar. And Thomas Aquinas also adopted the geocentric model as the Greek philosophers did. And so, when the church reacted to Galileo, it wasn't faith versus science. It was science versus science. Because the heliocentric model, the theory that it was actually the sun that was at the center and the earth and the planets revolved around it, was proposed by Nicholas Copernicus and Galileo advanced by Johannes Kepler.
It was this human-centric model that was later adopted. Remember, Nicholas Copernicus kept it quiet, and it was, in fact, posthumously published. His works were posthumously published after his death, and it was this view, the heliocentric model, that was being attacked, because the Roman Catholic Church simply adopted the geocentric model from the scientists of the day. And so this is one of the greatest myths that we see today in our world. Now, the other thing about science that we must be careful about is that science can tell us how things work, but they cannot rule in the domain of morals. For instance, in a court of law, a court could bring in evidence, for instance, DNA evidence, to exonerate someone of an alleged crime. But what science cannot do is science cannot determine whether or not certain moral acts are evil. Science cannot determine whether rape is evil. Science cannot determine whether child abuse is evil, because it is not the domain of science to rule in the area of morality. This is the realm of philosophy, the realm of faith, if you will. Science, therefore, is limited to a certain degree. It's also limited by the fact that it depends on what's called a scientific method, which involves observation, repeatable experiments, data, etc., compared to the historical method, for instance. Vast differences. The historical method functions very differently. We don't have repeated events. We don't have repeatable experiments. What we have is inscriptions, archaeology, probability, and the historian's task is very different than that of the scientist, that depends on present observation of events. And so what we must realize is the Galileo myth, as I call it, really is that. Galileo was not a case of science versus faith. It was actually a case of science versus science. Now, the other thing that we want to address, and you heard a little bit about the Big Bang Theory, and the Big Bang Theory espouses the view that the universe had a beginning. Since Aristotle, however, the view was that the universe was eternal. Now, this is very important, because until the Big Bang Theory emerged, the view was that the universe simply existed. It always existed. There was no beginning to the universe. And so, where did they get the idea from? They got it from the Greek philosophers. This is the view of materialism. However, the Big Bang Theory shows that time, space, matter, and energy were created at that point, and that the Big Bang posits a cause and effect relation, and that the cause must necessarily transcend the effect. The cause must be greater than the effect. And also, here's something else. The Big Bang Theory implies creation out of nothing, that is, creatio ex nihilo. But the problem here is we've got a bit of a philosophical dilemma, because out of nothing, nothing comes. Now notice what a number of scientists and philosophers have said about the Big Bang Theory. Clinton Smith, for instance, says that, quote, is the most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. I don't know about you, when I first read this, this was very depressing. We came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. You are meaningless, purposeless. There's no purpose for your existence. You are here because you're here, so get used to it. Look at Anthony Kenney. A proponent of the Big Bang Theory, at least if he is an atheist, must believe that the universe came from nothing and by nothing. What is interesting from a faith perspective is that Christian theologians have been saying for centuries that the God of the Bible created the universe out of nothing by his spoken word. There's an old joke about scientists going up this great mountain, the mountain of knowledge, and as they're going up, they reach the peak only to be confronted by a band of theologians who are waiting for them. Now, David Hume has also pointed this out, and Peter quoted Hume earlier. David Hume, the great skeptic philosopher, I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. He himself realized that that was a silly proposition. Scientists, philosophers, again, Kai Nielsen, a very well-known atheist philosopher, suppose you suddenly hear a loud bang, and you ask me, what made that bang? And I reply, nothing, it just happened. You would not accept that. Now, on Victoria Day and Canada Day and July 4th, when you hear the bangs go off, we know that there's a cause to those bangs. And I'm interested in the Big Bang Theory, but I'm more interested in what made it go bang. And Stephen Hawking says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, this is quite a difficult pill for many atheist philosophers and agnostic philosophers and scientists to accept, because what it says is that the universe had a beginning, then the universe had a cause. What was that cause? Derek Parfit says, quote, no question is more sublime than why there is a universe, why there is anything rather than nothing. Now, the Kalam cosmological argument has been raised by Peter, but I want to go through it again because I think it's very important. Al-Ghazali, who was a Muslim philosopher, put this together. The Kalam is an Arabic word for word. And basically it says, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Now, it's very carefully worded. It doesn't say everything that exists has a cause. It points out that whatever begins to exist has a cause. This is what's known as a hypothetical syllogism. That the conclusion falls from the premise. It's like the old syllogism, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. The conclusion, three, follows logically from the premise, number one. How do we then judge and weigh the evidence? Well, the inference to the best explanation. How do we do that? We collect a body of data. We look at this body of data and try to explain it. We look at the various explanations for that body of data. We've heard a few of them mentioned here tonight. The explanation which, if true, would best explain the observable data, that's the one you should take. Which direction does the weight of evidence lean towards as an explanation for the origin of the cosmos? Socrates is reputed to have said, to follow the truth wherever it leads you. Follow the truth wherever it leads you. And I think that's what Michael Behe did in his book, Darwin's Black Box. He took the evidence and he let it lead him. To what conclusion? That the Darwinian theory is simply highly implausible. We look at the theories. Is it evolution that accounts for what we know of? Is it intelligent design? Is it creationism? Is it the anthropic principle? That's simply a term that philosophers use that basically means that the planet Earth looks designed, it looks as if it was deliberately put that way to inhabit life. It's on the right axis, the degrees is a perfect axis. It has water, which is a necessary component for life. It's fine-tuned, even the universe is fine-tuned. This is what they call the anthropic principle. The planet looks like it was deliberately designed to allow for the existence of life as we know it. I want to quote to you Dr. Michael Roos, who is a Canadian himself, who is a professor emeritus of the University of Guelph, and I want you to please notice his words very carefully. This was in the National Post of May 13, 2000, and he has entitled the article, How Evolution Became a Religion. Please listen to his words. Quote, evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity, with meaning and morality. I'm an ardent evolutionist and an ex-Christian, but I must admit that in this one complaint, the literalists, and these are creationists, are absolutely right. Now listen to these words. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it is true of evolution still today. Why is it a religion? Because evolutionists must function on faith. They must assume that there was a primordial seed, a soup. They must assume that all life arose from the seas and that they went through, as we've heard, the ooze to the zoo to you. They must assume a whole bunch of categories, a whole bunch of ideas. Based on what? Evidence? No. Based on assumption, a priori assumptions. So even evolutionists, everyone lives by faith. When you get into your car and you turn the engine, you are going by faith that car is going to get you from point A to point B. As you sit on these chairs, you're hoping by faith that those chairs are going to hold you up. Everyone uses faith. Even the evolutionist needs faith. Now notice what Dr. Roos also says. Why should a bunch of atoms have thinking ability? Why should I, even as I write now, be able to reflect on what I am doing, and why should you, as you read now, be able to ponder my points, agreeing or disagreeing with pleasure or pain, deciding to refute me or deciding that I am just not worth the effort? No one, certainly not the Darwinian as such, seems to have an answer to this. The point is, there is no scientific answer. How do you explain love when you're in love with someone? When a husband loves his wife or a wife loves... how do you explain that? Does evolution explain that? Justice, the idea of morality and justice and human rights?
Where do these ideas come from? Do they come from naturalism? From natural selection? These ideas are much deeper than that. And I think that's what Dr. Roos is getting at. How do you explain this reality? B.F. Skinner tried to say that, well, you know, everything is all in the brain. And love is simply the firing off of neurons. It's all mechanical. But why does it only go on for this particular person that you call your wife? Why not everybody else? And when it does happen to everybody else, we've got problems in our society. And we have problems in marriage when that happens. And so, how do you explain love? How do you explain these deep ideas, even the idea of thought and consciousness? That cannot be explained by evolution, because evolution is necessarily materialistic. It is not interested in the abstract, it's interested in the materialism. Now, there was an interesting article in Newsweek, I don't know if you've read it, a very interesting article in Newsweek, where the atheists, who are 2,500 strong, are trying to react to the full-fledged force of the Christian right in the United States, and they're trying to counter now, and they're trying to make good arguments for atheism. You've got Richard Dawkins, for instance, the author of The God Delusion. What is interesting in the Newsweek article is that it made reference to an astronomer, a very well-known astronomer in the United States, Professor Carolyn Porkle, and on her website, edge.org, I want to read this to you. It's very interesting. It says that astronomer Carolyn Porkle offers the subversive suggestion that science itself should attempt to supplant God in Western culture by providing the benefits and comforts people find in religion, community, ceremony, a sense of awe. In other words, let's borrow the same language, like community, a sense of awe, and she says, imagine congregations raising their voice in tribute to gravity, the force that binds us all. It sounds like Star Wars, the force, may the force be with you. Imagine congregations raising their voice in tribute to gravity, the force that binds us all to the earth, and the earth to the sun, and the sun to the Milky Way. So you see what's happening is we don't have the designer or God or whatever you want to call it in the picture, but we'll substitute it with another capital G. And we'll call it, not the G-spot, we'll call it gravity. So you see, what's happening here is they're simply taking that idea that theists call God and simply supplanting it. Carl Sagan tried to do the same thing. He would deny the existence of any designer, but he would always speak of nature with a capital N. You see, there's a necessity for a reference point in life. But Professor Carolyn realized one problem. She said, the people who want to know that they're going to live forever and meet mom and dad in heaven, she said, we can't offer any answers to those questions. And so my point here tonight is to show that science is limited to a certain extent, that there is an origin and a nature to science. And science is limited only in the extent that what is true to ourselves, to our world, is what can be tested, what can be observed. And in the area of origins, unfortunately, we are left in an area where we have to look at the evidence, we have to weigh the evidence, and ask ourselves the question, out of the evidence that we know of, that we have, what better model suits what we know? What better model explains our world? Is it evolution? Is it creation? Is it intelligent design? Whatever it may be, you have the choice to make tonight. I thank you for your time.
We have time for two questions before Errol comes. And if you would be so kind, please to...
Sure.
There's one.
Yes.
If scientists, agnostics, atheists, they ridicule the Big Bang Theory and whatnot, why is this so widely accepted in the world? There are textbooks that are everywhere.
Why is what accepted, sorry?
The Big Bang Theory.
The Big Bang Theory? I think because the when it first came out, I think the evidence is quite overwhelming. The expanding universe, the redshift, etc. I think the evidence is pointing in that direction. But the other problem is the implications, the ramifications of the Big Bang Theory leads you to the conclusion that if the universe had a beginning and that it's not eternal, well then, what is the cause of the universe? And I think that the problem is not so much scientific as it is philosophical.
they're trying to avoid the conclusion, and that is that something made the universe. Yes?
Can you quickly explain like the difference between the age of the universe with the Bible is at 6,000, 7,000 years versus billions of years? What's the view of any of you?
Well, on this issue, there will always be dissension among people of religious convictions. If you look at the biblical account hones in on the earth itself. It looks at what happened on day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. It doesn't necessarily go into details about the universe per se, as we know, the Milky Way, etc. And so the Bible is geocentric in that respect. But there are Christians who will differ on this. There are Christians who will say that the days of Genesis 1 and 2 are to be taken literally. 6 24-hour periods and God resting on 7. There are those who will say that that those days represent huge gaps of time. And on this, I think we will never find a resolution. Now, if you were to ask me, if I were to speak from a theological perspective, I would say that when Moses wrote, when he used the Hebrew word yom, which is the word for day, it was a 24-hour period. But on this issue of origins, as I said, we'll always have dissension. So it really is an unresolved issue for me. Yes, sir.
Dr. Ruse, in his statement, called himself a ex-Christian.
Yes.
That flies in the face of eternity. Obviously, whatever he had before has changed, therefore it wasn't connected with the eternal.
Right.
Is he saying then that there's no such thing as the eternal?
I don't know if he is denying it. I think he would say that the eternal is an abstract idea that exists in the mind, just as the infinity of numbers exists in the mind. I think that would be his perspective on things. I don't know what led to his apostasy or falling away from his Christian heritage. But I think that last quote I gave you, the whole idea is that the idea of consciousness is something that is foreign to the material world as we know it. It's an abstract category.
I can make the statement that I'm X something, that means I left something behind to think about something new.
Right.
Therefore, that what I left behind is false.
Right.
And it doesn't affect me any longer.
Right.
But you can't say that about time, because time, where did it start and where does it end?
Exactly.
He doesn't know.
Well, there are reasons why people leave their faith. Some people, it's our greatest.
Poor guy is still learning.
It's still learning.
We have time for one more.
Knowledge and happiness.
Right up there.
Oh,
yes.
All right.
Yes,
how come more isn't made of the West design theory, right? It says, could you make evolutionists more happy? I mean, if God was there and put the eyeball on Earth and then let it evolve, like, who are we to say that God didn't allow amino acids to form proteins. How come we can't? He gave us a little spark.
Right.
We
can say that, but Darwin wouldn't say that.
No.
That's the point. He simply removed the designer out of the whole picture. And as Dr. Perry pointed out, it was all chance without a designer whatsoever. So there's no intelligence directing it at all. So, I mean, there are such things as theistic evolutionists. I've met a number of them. One prominent physiologist at the University of Toronto, who is a believer in God, but he believes that God used the mechanism of evolution to bring about what we see today. And, of course, I find that very compatible, personally, or with intelligence.
Okay, we have time for questions on a one-on-one basis during refreshments, but I want to bring to you this announcement. Thank you, Tony, so much. One thing that all four of us speakers tonight have in common is that we've all studied at the U of T. I did a course in astronomy there. And we're having a conference September 29th. It's in 2 weeks. It's a Friday night and Saturday. We'd urge you to come Friday night especially and bring your friends, because there's going to be some great speakers. We have Dr. David Humphreys, who is a professor. Okay, well, you have the card. You know the details. Dr. Hugh Ross is an astronomer and has some wonderful, powerful concepts for you to absorb. Dr. David Humphreys is a professor emeritus of chemistry at McMaster University. And they'll be coming along with K. Kevin Wood for some artistic relief. And speaking of that, I want to pull down for you Errol, who's going to do a couple of numbers to finish our time.